I will once I get the slivers out of my hands from yesterday. I mentioned that because this morning I need to tell you I am tired. Physically, it's been a long week, weary. That doesn't make for the best preaching. So on days that I'm tired, I pick enormously simple passages. Not, and if I talk simply, it's not because I think you are simple, but because I am trying to make myself understood. And I also pick passages that are either a little controversial or move along so that the passage will provide the interest and the speaker doesn't have to. Another reason this morning for picking the passage we're going to pick is we spent the last, almost 2 months talking about our business meeting and preparing for it and things to do with it. And sometimes you can train too hard, too sharp. You can spend so much time training and getting ready for something that you need to ease off a little bit before you do it. And you need to be thinking a little bit broader. And so this morning what I want to do is take you to the book of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 11. And I want to take you to two passages this week and next week in Chronicles. And I want to talk a little bit about our perspective on the life of David. And to start with, just to remind you that God expects us to be constantly growing. Most of what we know about David has come from the same messages that were preached forever or what we learned in Sunday school. And once a view is set of something, we never get out of it. We have the same picture of David as a boy with Goliath. We have the same picture of Saul. We have the same picture of how Israel was. And I think there's some things that as we read the Bible, and as we grow in the Bible, we were supposed to have attained that we don't attain. One of them is, how many of you read Chronicles? Most of us, when we read about David, we read 1 and 2 Samuel. If you read 1 and 2 Samuel, the end of David's life is a very depressing matter. Now, what we have here in 1 Chronicles, I want you to notice this, 1 Chronicles chapter 11, and it is about David becoming the king. And this information that we're about to read is at the beginning of, is given at the beginning of the story of David. The life of David continues until, let me see how far before we actually get into Solomon. Right till the end of 1 Chronicles. In the last chapter, chapter 29. So what we're going to see, and I want you to notice something, is what we're about to read today about David's mighty men. This is information that is given at the end of 1 Samuel, not at the beginning of the story. This writer gets all of this about this military side of David out of the way quickly, and then he moves on to other things. We never do. I think that when we view David as a king, a warrior, and a poet. And we view him in his life and the events of his life, and we view the events of his life as they're given in Samuel, because Samuel kind of follows a chronology of his life. And yet Chronicles, you have to understand the difference between 1 Samuel and Chronicles is that they're separated by, 600 years. Chronicles is written in the 400s, whereas Kings is written in the 500s, and 1 Samuel is written at the time of the life of David, which would be around 1000. So Chronicles is actually looking back at the events and saying, let me put these in perspective in history for you. Let me look at where we are now and the role that each of these people played. Whereas Samuel is written right around the time of David, right around David and Solomon, it's contemporary accounts, and it's how people look at things then and what they see then. And that we always know that doesn't put us in the best perspective. It gives you a closer picture. It gives you a more emotional picture. It gives you a more personal picture to get these events. When you read 1 Samuel and Chronicles, it's much more personal in 1 Samuel. Much more seeing the ups and the downs in his life. You don't see a lot about David's sins in 1 Chronicles. You see other things about the role that God was using him for. So they're both necessary. 1 Samuel gives us a side of David that we need to see. But as we come to Chronicles, what we're about to deal with today is a little bit on this passage of the mighty men. And what I want to look at, and something we've talked about before, is looking at David as a military man, and looking at Israel and their might and their conquests, the book of Judges and the life of Saul and the life of David and Solomon, and about looking at Israel as a nation, about how they were blessed and when they were, you know, doing the right things, they were on top and they were in charge of all the nations around them, and how they weren't following the Lord, they were down in the valley and all the other nations had in charge of them. So we kind of look at Israel in terms of military might and whether they're dominating their neighbors or being dominated. And we look at David as a complicated man, but basically in history, he's a military figure. All the greatest events we remind him of are military. But let me remind you, if you do that, in the book of 1 Samuel, you'll come to the end of David's life with two things happening. David numbers the people. That's the end of David's life. We have this story where all of the mighty men are listed. That is a numbering of the troops. Literally, this 30, that 30, these 3, that 3. That's numbering the troops. We'll talk about what that means in the life of David. The next thing we have is because that happened, because he numbered the troops, we'll look at that next week, God sent a plague upon Israel. God punished Israel for David's taking a census and numbering his army. And then the great plague in the last chapter, Samuel comes along, destroys the one-third of the people, just terrible in that region, not of all the people of Israel. The plague comes along. And then the next thing that happens after that is David's, in 1 Kings chapter 1, old, cold, impotent, a little frail, weak shell of a man. This man who had had so many wives and been so strong, lying in bed, freezing. They've got to get a young woman just to keep him warm. He's helpless. His kingdom is being taken by the one son who shouldn't have it. And you see the end of David's life, it's like, wow. What happened there? You go from this figure, this young boy, strong and all these things, and now the end of his life, what are we supposed to think of David? Well, that's not what we're supposed to think of David. But when you follow the track of David's life that Samuel follows, and the sins that he committed and his family, and look at it that way, you see that picture. Here, however, Chronicles chooses to start with the numbering of the troops. Chooses to start with David and his military conquests, and the city of David and all of those things. Then it moves on to what's more important in the history of Israel about David's life. I'd invite you, I'd ask you to read 1 Chronicles this week, starting in chapter 12, and it'll be amazing, we'll cover that next week, what 1 Chronicles wants you to learn about David as a king, what it emphasizes about his kingship. So, first today though, I want to take some time before we do that and talk about what the connection is between David and the military and the difference of thinking between a military thinking and the thinking on broader issues. As we say that, this passage is because both are necessary. It was necessary for David to have an army. It was necessary for David to be a military man. It was necessary for that army to defend Israel. All these things are absolutely necessary. So when we're talking about this, I don't want to give the impression, that's why I decided to preach it in 2 weeks, that, well, let's look at David as a military man, and that wasn't very important, and we want to pass that by. I want to spend some time thinking that way and looking at that, and then in perspective say, but what God wants us to look at beyond that, more than that about David. And one of the reasons I'm speaking on this today is America changes so rapidly that we end up living like the book of 1 Samuel, right in the events, not able to put things in perspective, not able to step out and say, you know, what is really going on here? If you look at America now, as opposed to 10 years ago, one of the things that is so different is how military-minded we are as a people. Now, there's a difference between the military being military-minded and the people being military-minded. I want to remind you of that. There's a reason for an army and not in the army. They think very different. But it's amazing to see how many wars America has engaged in the last 10 years, how many armed conflicts, how many civil wars we've engaged in, how different the fighting that our troops are doing now, insurgency, counterinsurgency, acting as a police force, how different things are. 10 years ago, you never would have suspected that America would be in as many places, doing as many things, with as few resources, stretched, and how what a great emphasis we'd have on the military. And it's interesting to me to see how this military metaphor is being carried over into Christianity, and is always carried over into Christianity. This harks back to the 60s. But I don't know how many times when the emphasis on the 60s was we're soldiers for God, we're fighting for God, we've got to think like soldiers. I can remember being in 8 years old, 1964. Oh, that was the year Barry Goldwater was running for president, wasn't it not? What year was he running for president? Was it 1960 or 64? Anybody, somebody remember? I don't know. 64. And Barry Goldwater was the arch hawk. He was just everything. And running against a Kennedy, right? For Kennedy's second term? I don't know. I was 8 years old. I don't remember all those things. All I remember is my dad had big Goldwater stickers on the back of our Volkswagen. Yeah, you know, so I said all these militaristic, on the back of a little Volkswagen. But it's amazing to me how the way churches spoke in the 60s reflected the tension of the Cold War, reflected the military aspect. Our military was just expanding in the 60s. It was growing exponentially to not only to meet the threats that we were already engaged in, but to spread into Vietnam and to do other things. And churches reflected that. And we're starting to see the same thing in churches today. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about that. And to do that, you have to understand a difference between a ministry mindset and a military mindset, bearing in your minds that both are necessary. Okay? You don't go out, there's a difference between the police and the military. The Marines' motto isn't to protect and to serve. That's just not how they think. You can't work that way. But I want you to see the different places that both play by looking at one of David's mighty men. Today I picked one that the two or three that I speak on at different times. I'm going to speak on Benaiah, beginning in verse 22, because Benaiah is going to be David's military man who continues into the life of Solomon. He will be the military man who's just a sergeant, a captain, while David is going through all of his exploits, but he becomes the chief general of the army under Solomon. He is the man who protects the kingdom for Solomon. So what we're going to see about Benaiah here is a great example of what it means to think in a military fashion, and his life is a great example because during David's life, he's totally involved in the nuts and bolts of military life, as we're going to see, but he's also the guy who, when David is too old to do anything, takes charge and preserves Solomon's life, preserves the kingdom, and he becomes the chief general of the armies. Here, though, notice he's buried within this passage. This passage is divided up by threes and thirties. Very typical, threes and thirties, when you're reading about military things. It's always interesting in the Bible that this idea of dividing things up by threes, that actually came from the Philistines. God used the Philistines to teach Israel how to fight. Israel was a bunch of ragtag guys with a bunch of pitchforks and old weapons, and when the need arose, they would come down out of the hills and fight. God turned them into a nation with a standing army. That is good and bad. A standing army is very expensive. That's why our country switched from a standing army to an army that has reserves being called up for warfare. But they switched that and became organized militarily. The Philistines always did things by threes. Always worked in groups of threes. So when you see these threes and thirties here, there are 30, and with each 30 there's a top three. That comes from a military way of thinking that Israel had actually gained from the Philistines while David served with the Philistines. He served as a captain in their armies, as a raider for them, and he saw these people know what warfare is all about. So he learned from them. We'll begin reading verse 20. Abishai, the brother of Joab, was chief of the second three. There are three groups of mighty men. Okay? Benaiah isn't part of the first group of mighty men. He's not one of the top three. The top three are already there. We're starting the middle. The second three begin with Abishai. He lifted up his spear against 300 men, killed them, and won a name among the three. Of these three, he was more honored than the other two men. Therefore, he became their captain. However, he did not attain to the first three. You know, both in the military, in the military way of thinking of life, it's about rank and about being satisfied with your rank. In military, everything you do, every time somebody looks at you, they know where you fit. It's right on your shoulders, right there on your collar points. They know where you are within the organization, and you better be comfortable with it. You got the idea that I don't like being a sergeant. I don't like being a second lieutenant. I guess no one likes being a second lieutenant. My dad was a sergeant, but second lieutenant's kind of like the people who are learning to be officers and not qualified, and everybody's scared stiff about what decisions they may be making, so usually the sergeants have to make all their decisions for them. But when you see a person's rank, the rank is out there, and it's not a mark of their pride or their achievement. It's a mark of where they stand and how things are ranked and ordered, and everything's about a position, a rank, and who's here and who's there, and everything has a name, and this passage is laid out that way. I want to remind you, that's not how the church works. There are no ranks and orders. We don't see that in the church. We don't see that in heaven. We don't see any of these sorts of things. The military has to do it because of their mission, because of the way that they think, because of the way that they're organized. But one of the things that's interesting is, anybody remember anything about Abishai? I shouldn't ask that question. Look at 2 Samuel 23. I want to tell you a little bit about this Abishai. Yeah, I think it's 2 Samuel 23. I wish I had written it in the border here so I didn't have to... No, this is just going to give me the other place. Joab had two brothers. See if I can find that passage for you real quickly while we're talking here. Joab had one brother who was kind of just there and not mentioned. And then he had one brother who was absolutely positively a blight upon the name of his family. Give me a second to find it here. I'm coming right back to the beginning of 1 Samuel chapter 6 or 5. Here we go. Second Samuel chapter 3. What had happened is when Saul died, the kingdom splits between the people who think David ought to be king and the people who are loyal to follow Saul. They follow his nitwit son Ishbosheth. Alright? Now there are people who are in Saul's army defecting to David. Abner was the chief of Saul's forces. He defects to David. The trouble is, Joab and his brothers hated Abner. They're jealous of him, always hated Abner, because Abner had done something. They had a younger brother. There were three brothers, Joab, Abishai, and a younger brother, Asahel. Asahel, was young and fast and impetuous. And there was a battle, and the forces of Joab and Abishai and Asahel won, and the forces of Abner lost, and they're running. And Asahel keeps following after them. Now, that was against biblical law. When your enemy left, if they were brothers, you let them leave. If they were Canaanites, you needed to destroy them. But if they were brothers, when the battle's over, no unnecessary killing. So he's all caught up in that, and he's running and running. Unfortunately, the soldier he catches up to is Abner, who is a really mighty man of war. And he says, come, stop and fight with me. You know that little dog that wants to fight the Doberman, you know? And he says, no, he says, get away, I don't want to fight you. No, fight me. He says, no, he says, how can I look you brother in the eye if I killed you? What? Kill me? No, and he jumps at him. So he takes the end of his spear and pushes him away. Unfortunately, it goes in under the rib, right into the heart, and the younger brother dies. He didn't intend to kill him. There's a young guy's dumb stupidity, breaking the law, doing everything that killed him. All right? But Abner and Asa and Abishai never forget about it. And they murder, but Joab and Abishai never forget about it. And in 2 Samuel, chapter 2, verse 30, we'll just read one verse. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel in Gibeon in battle. The first of these three that we're about to talk about, come back to our portion. There are two groups of three. The first in this group of three is Abishai, and he's a murderer. He's the guy who got his position because his brother was the captain of the army. He's the guy who plotted with his brother not to stand up against somebody in one-on-one combat. We don't know anything about his deeds until we come here. You never hear about him in the story. He's number one, and Benaiah is number two. You would think that that would rankle people. You'd think that that would be a sense of, why is he above me? Why does this guy, and why can't, you can't serve in the military if that's your mindset. If your mindset is, I don't want to be in this position, that person above me, or that person who got that honor didn't deserve it, you cannot be in the military. And this entire group of ranking here, it's interesting how in American society, we struggle with this. We don't even like to hand out awards because if somebody doesn't receive an award, there's something wrong with that. So sometimes with little kids, everybody gets some kind of award. You know, you get the, it's really sad, the awards we think of. You know, you always get the, you know, most enthusiastic, brother, meaning the one who annoyed us the most, you know, or you're the most this, and it's like, oh, everybody walks away with an award. Usually your award's this big and his is this big, but you're all our winner here. Well, not in the military. Rank and ordering, you can't all be the same. And awards and honors don't come equally. And Benaiah doesn't bother him. Benaiah, we don't see any of that. And this is, in the ranking here, we see him starting out in the middle of things. We're going to see he grows. But a military framework dominates everything. You can't go into the military for your own glory. Some go into everything, but you cannot and be successful. You have to be part of a team. You've got to be part of a rank and an order. And where do I fit? Tell me what to do. I must do this. How do I work? There's an element of that mindset in the church. But it's not the church. There's nothing wrong with that mindset. It's a necessary part of many parts of life. But it dominates the military. That idea of rank and order, I don't care if you're above me, you're the one that's above me. The idea that honors come unequally, and I have to learn to live with that. It's about getting the job done. Notice something else here. Benaiah was the son of Jehoiada, who was the son of a valiant man from Kabzeel who had done many deeds. Just that little phrase, knock it off for a second. It says, he was the son of Jehoiada, who himself was the son of a mighty man who had done many deeds, the man from Kabzeel. And so he's saying his grandfather was a warrior just like him and done many deeds, and he comes from a race of warriors. Well, that's interesting. Now, who is Jehoiada? Guys, he's the high priest. He's the high priest. Now, you don't see that here, do you? You would think that in reciting somebody's lineage, the thing that you would emphasize is you're a Levite. You can't be the son of the high priest and not be a Levite, correct? You can't. You're a Levite, your father's a high priest? No. In the military, that made no difference. It was his grandfather, who was a warrior like him, that's important. That's not wrong. Give me, everybody looks at what they like. You know, I look back at generations of people before me, and you go back through your family tree and see, was anybody else interested in teaching? Actually, I don't know if I told you this, at home, I just found it again, I've got to get that done this week, got a family tree that stretches all the way back to England. had one ancestor who came over on the Mayflower, whatever, right there on the thing. I give beans about him. You know, I don't care. He didn't do anything. I've got one ancestor, though, who was a Baptist, who fought for the principle of congregational church government, who fought for the principle of soul liberty, and who helped to found the nation of the country of Rhode Island. He exiled himself voluntarily from Massachusetts to help found Rhode Island. That guy I'm proud of. And I don't know, all these other people might have done great things. They might have been all kinds of wonderful things. This guy might have been, you know, the best seamstress in the world or whatever, tailor or whatever they are. Could have done any of those things, but it means nothing to me. Nothing. We care about what we care about. And we look at things that way. We look back for our lineage, and that's that one person out of the thousands of people who are up there. That's the one I care about. Well, that's the point of the military. You tend to focus in on those sorts of things. You're proud of what you're proud of. He came from that mighty man, even though his dad was a high priest. Now, by the way, I bet his dad was proud of him. I'm not saying that because his dad was a high priest, he should have been a high priest. But it doesn't work that way. Younger sons don't become the high priest. So don't get the idea that every Levite didn't involve in different things, which is kind of an interesting story here. But it's interesting that narrow focus, they go right past that. By the way, his name appears all over this book, Jehoiada. But here, he's just a... But let me get to the real important one, who's a military man. Any profession, especially the military, sucks you right in. Everything becomes a new set of values. In fact, that's what basic training is all about. Taking away every value but one. You want to be part of a unit. You want to please. You want to be valued. Your value comes from who you are in the military and those things that you see and those things that you do. When Aaron went into the military, he joined the 82nd Airborne. Turns out that before it was airborne, it was the division where it was the All-American division that had gone over to fight in World War I. And Alvin York, Sergeant York, was part of that. And you better believe anybody in the 82nd Airborne can go back and talk about who has done what in our division for how long and all of those sorts of things. Driving down Main Street on the way to Peckville, you'll see a yard with two A's, long on the side and short in the center, two A's facing each other. It's the 82nd Airborne symbol. It's in his front yard. Here's an 82nd Airborne, and that's him for life. The military marks you. It changes you in a good way, I trust. It ought to. It's meant to. But you never are the same. And in the military, there are always those who are soldiers who were soldiers and those who are not. Same way in the police force. The police force, you're either law enforcement or you're the rest. You're civilian. And when you're in this, anybody of you know people who've been in the police community, it's a very closed community. You say things to people, you think different, but every person is either a police officer or on the outside. Everybody tends to do that. And in military thinking, it dominates your thinking. It's all of your values right there. And even in the way that this is being listed among these three, any other place, Jehoiada would have gotten this huge notice. Not here. There's nothing wrong with it because he's not supposed to receive it here. But they're on to what's important to them. Next, notice what he did. This is Benaiah, killed two lion-like heroes of Moab. It's interesting how many times lions are connected with Moab. I'll get on that if I don't stop. But just so many times you see lions in Moab, and it's part of the symbology that they use, two of their heroes. Okay? He also had gone down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit on a snowy day. Now, snowy days don't bother us. We're here, but they bother you there because if it's snowing, it's cold. You're wearing something to, in those days, wool or fur. The first thing that happens to wool and fur when you get the snow is it gets sodden and wet and heavy, and it's just a horrible thing to try to fight when you're weighted down, when you're just carrying all this weight. So he jumps into the pit with this lion, and notice why he killed the lion in the pit. My view is he's in the pit, I'm up here, hey, life's good, you know. So when you put me in the pit, the problem starts. But not Benaiah. Yeah, jumps down. Actually, the only son we had that went into the military was that kind of yeah kind of person. You know, just, hey, I can try this, you know. He was a wrestler. You know wrestlers, you know. Bang your head against the wall. How many times, sir? You know, that's their way of thinking, you know. So notice, and he killed an Egyptian, which of course, was kudos in everybody's camp back then. A man of great height, he was 7.5 feet tall. In the Egyptian hand, there was a spear like a weaver's beam. When you're weaving, you need one very strong wooden pole at the end because you're constantly pulling all the threads against it. They're all looped around that one at the end. And when you're weaving, you're constantly tightening up all the threads so that you can make your rug or make your tapestry very tight. So all that pressure of all those strings is pulling against this wooden dowel. And it's not a beam like this, you know, square. It's round. So it's big, thick, and hard. And by the way, you don't carry a big, thick, and hard spear. Because they're heavy, because they're unwieldy, because you cannot either throw them far, you can't anything that's really heavy like that, especially wood, it's hard to pierce. You want something that's light and thin and heavy, because that gives you the momentum for piercing. So the only people who carry something big and heavy are somebody who are so big that that seems small to them. So this is, and by the way, back then, the size of your opponent mattered. You know, we always, you know, see these little kung fu movies with these tiny little 4-foot kung fu guys, you know, like Yoda, you know, are always doing all this stuff. Not back then. In battle, he's 4 foot, you're 6 foot. That's why God made feet. You know, come and get me, you know. Forget that noise. The big guys won back then. Big guys, it made no difference back then. So he doesn't care. He jumps down into this pit and he takes care of the two lilac sons of Moab. He goes after this Egyptian, and the Egyptian's hand is pure like a weaver's beam. I love this. He went down to him with a staff. He's got a little walking stick. That's all he's got. Big stick, walking stick. He went down to him. And he took the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. Hey, God, you brought my weapon for me. I wasn't going to carry that all the way. You know, I needed to use it, but you can carry it for me. Actually, there are fighting techniques that have been used back then and today for disarming somebody with a stick. I watch a lot of weird things on TV, and I was watching, there's a Filipino fighting style called the Screamo, where they fight with fighting sticks. I've seen a little like that. And they were showing on TV how to take a fighting stick and disarm somebody. Just in case you're walking along with a stick and someone comes out with whatever, it's good information. You never know. It's like, wait a second, step over this way. Yep, okay, got you now. You know, that'll work just fine. Or you can run. You know, either one works. You know. But they're showing how you take a small stick, and it's really great because by getting the leverage between his hand and his weapon in the right way, so he takes it out of his hand and he kills him with his own spear. You know, there's a, just like David, remember? What did David do? What did he kill Goliath with? Not the stone. That's what put him down, with his own sword. He took Goliath's sword and chopped off his head. So when you ask how tall Goliath is, you have to ask at what period in his life, you know, the beginning or the end, different heights. My point is, this is what a military guy is. Anywhere, anytime, whoever, however, whatever it takes, I'm going to fight. The guy's a pit bull. You couldn't stop him. A lion in a pit, why not? Go for it. Well, I don't know what great military conquest was done on the lion, where the lion was like holding a piece of territory that you needed to occupy. He didn't care. He didn't care if there were two heroes, these people from Moab would have been trained fighters, heroes working together. He didn't care about that. Didn't care about the size. Didn't care about whether it was the winter or the summer. His job was to fight, and his job was to be aggressive. Probably the greatest quality in military, the people who are successful in military, is aggression. Not lack of fear, by the way. That's not the point. It's the idea of being aggressive. It's the idea of not letting fear dominate. The idea of I will be aggressive, and I will take action, and I'm going to do what needs to be done. There's another show that's very interesting. I flip. It's on the History Channel. It's called Dogfights. They actually take you back. Have you guys seen this one? Awesome. If you have, you get hooked on it. They use actual animation to recreate very famous dogfights from the beginning. And it's fascinating because they talk about the tactics. And they talk about what exactly, and they use the same tactics, I guess, since World War I, just variations of them. But several of the men, they ask him, what made that guy a good fighter? He was aggressive. He never stopped. Several of them, you know, they were shot up, and they just put two people down or headed back home when they see another plane down there, and only have enough fuel to get on the plane. It's like, oh, why not? And they couldn't stop. They were just aggressive. That's what makes a military man. That's what made David. David was aggressive. Go for that. Go for this. I'm going to take this. When people sat around and Goliath is out there, David is like, there's the guy. What's the problem? Let me just take care of him. Let me kill him. By the way, that kind of single-minded aggression never left Benaiah. Let me take you to a couple passages. Look at 1 Kings. I told you that Benaiah was instrumental. I've got to move back to 1 Kings. Chapter 2 was instrumental in getting David to, or getting Solomon to be king. But look, if I can find this for you. First at verse 34. When Solomon comes to the throne, he's not a warrior. We never see Solomon doing anything in a warrior manner. That's good and bad, by the way. He inherited it. You never see him. He doesn't need to. He's got Benaiah. Earlier in the chapter, Benaiah was the one who said, David wanted Solomon to be king. I don't care if this goofy older younger brother wants to do something. We're going to make Solomon king. So Benaiah and Nathan the prophet and Bathsheba took over and got things done. But notice here, if I can find it here for you, chapter 2 and verse 24. Adonijah is the one who was the brother of Solomon who made himself king. Adonijah exalts himself, makes himself king, but it doesn't come off because Benaiah and the others quickly get Solomon anointed king in a more prominent place. All this while David's still alive, by the way. They didn't wait for David to die. Both Solomon and his brother got themselves anointed and were king while David was alive. Which says something about kings overlapping. Happened all the time in the Bible and chronologies. Kings' wives, two king people, their kingships overlap all the time. So, he becomes king. Now, what about Adonijah? Adonijah runs for it. Okay? Adonijah takes off and he runs and he holds on to the horns of the altar, which is a sacred place. The altar had these little projections from the sides of it for different things. One is to give it a little bit more... Well, we don't need to get into that. But he holds on to them. And it's kind of like running to a church for sanctuary. So he gets the sanctuary and nobody can touch him. But like all of David's sons, he's stupid, and including Solomon, and he doesn't let well enough alone. So he says, you know what? I'm out trying to be king a second time, but I'll do it sneaky. He wasn't good at sneaky. That could pull off sneaky. Just he tried it all his life. So what he does is he says to Solomon, I need a wife. And I'd like this particular woman to be my wife. What's wrong with that? Well, the woman that he asked for was part of David's harem. Was Abishag the Shunammite, who actually slept with David to keep him warm. But she was part of his harem. She was a wife. And the harem was there only for the king. And that harem nobody touched but a king. So by Adonijah asking for you to give me that woman, it's almost like Solomon admitting that you still have rights as a king. You still have a claim to the throne. Solomon, wise man, knew better than that. And he says, it's interesting, Adonijah in verse 20 of chapter 2 says, one small thing I ask, just let me have this one. It ain't so small. King Solomon takes in Bathsheba. Solomon says, if I give him this, he'll want the kingdom. This is just a step on the road to kingship. Verse 22, then Solomon swore by the Lord God, saying, may God do so to me, and more also, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life. If he doesn't die, may God kill me. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has confirmed me and set me on the throne of David my father, who has established a house for me, and he has promised today, Adonijah shall be put to death today. So King Solomon sent by the hand of Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down and he died. He'd kill anybody anytime. We don't read that Adonijah had a knife sneaking into the palace to kill. He might have been at home, you know, I don't know, playing chutes and ladders, you know, with his friends or whatever, and they're hanging around. He just comes in and goes, hi. Punk. He's dead. Benaiah, oh, job done. On to the next one. No lions, no Egyptians. I think I'll get some lunch. That's how it works. I kill. That's my job. You simplify it. By the way, in the military, you got to keep that simple. You don't have options. You don't shoot to wound. You don't shoot to wound. You know, there's this thing as shooting to wounding. That doesn't work. First of all, nobody's good enough to do that. Second of all, it's stupid to do that. Nobody does that. Benaiah knew that. A little bit more. Shimei. Shimei had given David all kinds of problems. He was this crazy, weirdo Benjamite running around when David was leaving the city. He threw stones and, we'll call them horse clods, at David and was jumping up and down and, you know, this bandy-legged little guy, oh, David, you're getting yours, you're getting yours. And David says, Joab wants to kill him. Let me kill this guy. Anybody talks to me, to you, let me kill him. I got a sword, run away. You know, it wouldn't take much time. Joab was just a pure killer, too. They go on their way. Then David comes back, and Shimei's like, people make mistakes. Through words, I missed with most of them. You know, you gave me too many. Can you forgive me? But Shimei is like all Benjamites. He's stubborn. He can't get off an idea once he gets it. David says, okay, you've got to live in the city. You can't go back out of the city. You can't go to the tribe of Benjamin again, because Jerusalem wasn't in the tribe of Benjamin. It was made a separate place. You can never leave the city. Okay, I'll live. He gets mad because a servant runs off. Shimei takes off after the servant. Solomon says in the end of this chapter, verse 36, and says, this is the story we're telling about 36 end of the chapter, says, you broke your parole. You were supposed to stay here. Parole is giving your word. It's the French word for word. You gave your word. You weren't supposed to break it. Nope. So what does he do? Second chance? The king says to Shimei, you know, as your heart acknowledges in verse 44, all this wickedness that you did to my father David. Therefore the Lord will return to you the wickedness on your own head. The king Solomon will be blessed, and the throne of David will be established in the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck him down, and he died. Killed him. Bandy-legged little old man. Benaiah is a soldier. Benaiah has a simple set of imperatives in life. I've got a place where I fit and a job that I do, and when I'm given an order, I carry out that order. I don't care about the consequences. The order makes the job right. It's interesting, in America, we talk a little bit about who should obey what order and those sorts of things. That thought is absolutely destructive of all military values. The idea that you'll be given an order and not carried out. Because you're a cog in that machine. You're not responsible. You didn't give the order. You are only responsible to carry it out. And the consequences of you not carrying out the order are always worse in your mind than the consequences of what you might do. You've got to think that way to be in the military. That is militaristic thinking. That is not wrong. But I want to let you know that that cannot dominate a king. That cannot be characteristic of a king. Kings cannot think in this short A to B fashion. Kings cannot be dominated. Kings cannot be those people that I just kill that person. They're aggressive. I fight whenever, wherever, whoever, however. They cannot do that. Now, kings cannot exist without people like Benaiah. He wouldn't have been king without Benaiah, nor with Solomon. But when we look at next week, I want you to see that God doesn't emphasize that David was a military man. In fact, God emphasizes that side of him was not the best side. And there are other things that Chronicles wants to emphasize. As we go along, I have a reason for this. We're seeing so many military metaphors. We're seeing so many things on our TV and our books that are emphasizing military and think like military. There is no conjunction at all for Baptists between military and the church. That's a metaphor that's present for other religious groups, but not for Baptists. We are not a military. We don't think like the military. Nothing wrong with that, but God has given us a different way of serving. He never saw others doing these sorts of things, because there's a role for everybody in society. I want to talk about David's next week. Hopefully I won't be as tired and I can do something a little bit more in depth. Let's pray. Oh, Father, we look at your word. We spent years hearing about David and these stories. I just pray that we might come to it as an adult. learning what, how we apply it to our lives, making us think more broadly, making us think about what's really here, asking why we didn't know these things. They're right in your word. Asking why you put these things here. Why is this the word that revives? Is this the word that gives life? How do these words that we study today sanctify us? What it is about these words that are meant to change our life? Bless us, Father. We have so many things that we feel you want us to do. We have so many things we know we ought to be doing or not. So many things we're doing and we know we shouldn't. But I pray all of your word would do its work in our hearts to make us who and what we ought to be more thoughtful. I praise you for the men who served and did the job and did what needed to be done. Men who were honored for what they did. May we honor them in that light and for those things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Of our loving Lord, grace that we stand in our building.